You've done so many different types of roles. I mean, you were talking about kind of being the guy that, the girl would bring home to mom and then kind
Right.
of bucking that image. I mean, of course, Timothy is 180 degrees away from that, but you've just been kind of every different type of character, and I love the turns. I mean, just comparing like Cinderella Man, you as Max Baer to Scary Movie 4. I mean, I loved Scary Movie 4. I thought it was
Oh,
terrific.
good, good.
And your performance in that is, for me, really, I mean, with all due respect to Anna Faris and everything, but you made the movie for me, and I was
Oh,
so
that's
happy to
very
see you
kind,
in
and how
that.
nice to hear. Thank you so much. Thank you.
I mean, do you ever have that little voice in your head thinking like, I don't want to be typecast as this kind of person, or have you had enough roles where you don't feel that that's ever going to be a problem for you?
Yeah, I don't feel like, I used to, I look at this stuff very personally, whereas, from the outside, as kind as you are, you can't help but have a more of a subjective view. If I think of any other actor, even though, I'm a quote unquote insider in the business, I think of somebody, oh, like Nicolas Cage. Here's a guy who, like, every time, you never know what to expect, and say what you will, the guy's brave. He takes choices. He's not scared when they turn the camera on. Like, he'll do shit. That's exciting. And I can't imagine, but I think of Nicolas Cage like that. I can't help, even though I hate typecasting, I can't help but have an impression that somebody's best on me. Even if they're all over the map, I think they're the all over the map guy. And, whereas somebody who I think is a truly amazing actor and from my own personal experiences, somebody like Tom Hanks, I can't help but see the guy in Splash, no matter what he does, because it was my first, because I had the same problem with Steve Martin. These are truly brilliant guys. They do everything. You sit and have a conversation with somebody like Tom Hanks, he is as funny, if not funnier, than anybody he's ever played. He's as warm as anybody he's ever played, which is often not the case. You get hit to the idea real fast that a lot of actors, you like them so much because very talented people are putting very likable words in their mouth, and they just happen to have a charisma. But when you meet them, you're like, whoa, this is incredibly disappointing. It's like, you want to perform an exorcism and pull out the ape, or the just the or just some people, a lot of times it's a void. I'd heard one person explain a movie star this way, that they were it was a sort of a chemical compound of charisma, looks, and vacancy, where a big segment that really for anybody else, and a lot of actors too, is filled in with personality, personal interests, habits, points of view. Whereas this person's theory anyway was that there's a void that the audience requires in order to project their needs on a person. Whereas it's a bad example because I think he truly was a very sensitive and from what I heard, a remarkable guy. But somebody like Cary Grant, who himself would say, "I wish I was Cary Grant." Like he was an invention. He was somebody that the studios concocted, and whatever it was that was uncertain or human about Cary Grant didn't appear on screen, or he could segment it off. But for a lot of the movie stars that I've come across, and I don't really even mean this as an insult, I just mean it like saying somebody has blonde hair. There's something missing, or not blonde hair, somebody who's bald, I guess it's a more appropriate analogy. But but there's something missing that you almost don't know it. Something like that could be missing until you realize, oh, I don't feel like this around other people in my life, because most people rarely meet movie stars. But it's an unease, dis-ease of that I have felt, because I feel like, oh, it could be something like I'm carrying too much of the conversation. I don't feel like I'm talking. Again, this all sounds like it's something hostile. It's just something. I'm talking about it as if I were a doctor and just saying somebody didn't you know, somebody's got a skin rash or something. It's just something that I've noticed. Not always, but usually for movie stars, it just seems to be something missing. I've had this conversation with people. They said, do you think it's something they've learned to protect? Well, I've seen that too. You know, I've seen people, but by and large, I think the things that round most people out, I'm going to go ahead and put myself in the category that isn't movie star and is more journeyman actor, which I wouldn't have liked at all in, you know, high school, but I actually am very proud of now. But I think part of the reason is that I do have a lot of interests that are all over the map. I've never planned out my career like that. I've never been in the kind of control where I can, you know, choose things, one or two projects down the line. Kind of, you know, I'm job hunting. I'm hunting sharks just like most boats have in the ocean. But the people who do have that sort of control, I wonder sometimes, you know, or a lot of times they get there because of, it's this weird arbitrary compound of happenstance. They fulfill physically what has to happen with a movie star. There's a certain amount of narcissism, which every actor has to have. I think most Americans have. But movie stars, it gets clinical. And on top of that, there's this void. I hope I'm not losing you, but it seems clear to me. But I think to go back to your earlier question, which I think you actually asked in 1973, was that I don't. It's never been a problem for me because I think there are too many doors that if they crack open a little bit, I want to go right through them. You know, if Larry David was remotely interested in me doing Sour Grapes, even though I read the script and thought I wouldn't be my first choice, I'm going in. I'm going to do it. And that's the, you know, I alluded to this thing that I'm writing. It's, you know, it's small time. It's not the kind of thing that somebody with 11 projects would have the time to even think about, but it interests me, and I'm able to follow through with a lot of stuff that I find personally intriguing. Usually, by the time I'm done playing a bad guy, it's time for me to get out of it. You know, I'm not one of those actors who like takes their work home, but you know, if you're killing people for, you know, 6 months or something, it can be a little hard to look at the world differently once you emerge into the world of dry cleaning and doing what everybody's doing. It's usually time to do something a little bit lighter. And I feel very fortunate to be able to change it up like that. I don't seem to be thought of as any one particular thing. And all I really care about is that I'm getting thought of. Really, that's all I really care about. If I'm getting thought, which just means that I'm more likely to work, you know. But thank you for what you said about Scary Movie, because he's David Zucker, who wrote and directed that with Craig Mazin, is a real hero of mine. And, you know, we're constantly talking about doing something else down the road, you know, together when the time comes. I don't think anybody does what he does anymore. I think there are a lot of copycats, but that's become an industry.
Kind of along those lines, both with Scary Movie and talking about, you know, Hollywood actor, superstar kind of stuff. And I might be overthinking this, but how was it kind of being this amalgamation of Tom Cruise and Mel Gibson? Talk about two kind of off-center actors, or at least in their personal lives, they come across that way, not necessarily on screen. Did you try to inhabit those?
No, not at all. As a matter of fact, here's another cool thing that people might not know about, you know, Zucker. Just I'm guessing that your very hip audience knows that he was, you know, a third of Zazz, you know, Zucker, even Zucker, who they did Kentucky Fried Movie, Airplane. They ushered in arguably a genre of comedy, which was sort of Mad Magazine, that sensibility come to life. And it's been copied a lot, but usually terribly. And Zucker is, you know, a third of that group. And he took over the Scary Movie franchise, the first two segments of which arguably were sort of copycatting their style, you know. But he sort of took over the franchise and injected the genuine vehicle to the franchise. And I was lucky enough to be in four, but he started with three. So if you think of Airplane, you kind of get this feeling of it's like watching Saturday Night Live. You're like, oh, this is naughty. We're watching something naughty. It felt subversive. Animal House was the same thing. But the truth is that none of those projects were, because what they were making fun of was authority, and authority has to greenlight all of those projects. So Saturday Night Live never truly made fun of the network, you know, NBC. They would edge up to the line, and they would, this is all my opinion, but they would convince the audience that the line was a little further back than it was, and it just seemed like they're always over the line. But they're not, because the network has to approve everything that they do. And that's what Zaz did with Airplane. Was there was this feeling of, oh my God, they're tearing into every movie and they're revealing everything that's so stupid about these movies. But the fact is that these, they're three men of conscience. And David, you know, I don't know the other two guys, but, you know, David's, his politics are very important to him, but he's also a very warm, caring, nice, sweet guy. And I thought, well, there's got to be something kind of sociopathic because of Airplane. But he explained to me that that was their game. They created the illusion of a line. As far as Tom Cruise was concerned, there was never, first of all, they could have hired somebody who looked a hell of a lot more like Tom Cruise than me. So they just wanted to hint. They wanted somebody who could, who I think at that point anyway was, you know, Cinderella Man and Long Kiss, and I'm trying to think of other things, but mainly I don't know that I was known as a comic actor, certainly not in movies. So somebody, I think they're kind of looking for that Leslie Nielsen thing where you're seeing somebody who inhabits the world of drama do all the silly stuff. It's not as funny as if you see a fully capable actor like Alec Baldwin, who's a brilliant actor. He can do it all. But he's also, because he can do it all, he's also known as a brilliant comedian and comic actor. They're almost not looking for that because you already know that. It's not as convincing in that world. So that, I think I represented that. And they were not looking for Tom Cruise. They didn't want that. They wanted a guy who just read as actor. I think they're vaguely familiar, but not overly familiar. And I know this to be true about the Tom Cruise stuff because there was another scene in there that was very, very funny that was more pointedly Tom Cruise than the jumping on a couch scene. I don't know if you remember, but there was another, he was on a Today show and he was going off on medication. You know, he was talking about the evils of medication.
Here's the problem. You don't know the history of psychiatry. I do. Aren't there examples, and might not Brooke Shields be an example of someone who benefited from one of those drugs? All it does is mask the problem, Matt. And if you understand the history of it, it masks the problem. That's what it does. That's all it does. You're not getting to the reason why. There is no such thing as a chemical imbalance.
So postpartum depression to you is Matt, kind of a little psychological gobbledygook?
No, I did not say that.
I'm just asking, what would you call it?
Matt, that is the post. Now you're talking about two different things.
But that's what she went on the antidepressant for.
But what happens, the antidepressant, all it does is mask the problem. There's ways of vitamins and through exercise and various things. I'm not saying that that isn't real. That's not what I'm saying. That's an alteration of what I'm saying. I'm saying that drugs aren't the answer. That these drugs are very dangerous. They're mind-altering drugs. And there are ways of doing it without that so that we don't end up in a brave new world. The thing that I'm saying about Brooke is that there's misinformation, okay? And she doesn't understand the history of psychiatry. She doesn't understand in the same way that you don't understand it, man.
Do you examine the possibility that these things do work for some people? That yes, there are abuses. And yes, maybe they've gone too far in certain areas. Maybe there are too many kids on Ritalin. Maybe electric shock.
Too many kids on Ritalin, Matt.
I'm just saying. But aren't there examples where it works?
Matt, you don't even, you're glib. You don't even know what Ritalin is. If you start talking about chemical imbalance, you have to evaluate and read the research papers on how they came up with these theories, Matt. Okay? That's what I've done. And you go and you say, where's the medical test? Where's the blood test that says how much Ritalin you're supposed to get?
It's very impressive to listen to you because clearly you've done the homework and you know the subject.
And you should. And you should do that also because just knowing people who are on Ritalin isn't enough. You should be a little bit more responsible in knowing
I'm not prescribing Ritalin, Tom, and I'm not asking anyone else to do it.
You're saying
some people who seem to have been helped by it.
This is a very important issue.
I couldn't agree more.
And you know what? And you're here on the Today Show.
Right.
And to talk about it in a way of saying, well, isn't it okay and being reasonable about it when you don't know, and I do.
You know, whatever. This is a point of view from his religion, and there was a very funny scene, and they decided not to shoot it. And I was kind of upset just because I thought it was so funny until they explained why they didn't want to shoot it. And I thought, you're right. I'm satisfied that we're not shooting this. It would be wrong to shoot it, which was, if you look back on their canon of work, they never go after anybody personally. They never disparage somebody for their beliefs. Even politically, they're pretty even-handed. I think they sort of create the illusion because they throw so much spaghetti at the wall that no matter what your particular point of view is, you're going to find something that represents your point of view. But really, just as many Republicans laugh as they are Democrats. You know, they're... I think really what they like to do is make fun of movies, not people. And I think it's one of the reasons, it's one of the things that sets them apart, and it's sort of an invisible reason. You know, these copycat movies just think, oh, you just have to twist and make fun of everything. But you can lose the audience. You know when you're watching a copycat movie like 5 minutes in, because one of those wrong, slightly off-key choices might be made. If you're not a musician, it's like listening to a really great bar band. You're like, you know, or one of those sound-alike bands. You're like, it's actually not the Beatles. You know, that's I don't know why it's not, but that wouldn't have happened if it was. You know, and I couldn't do a Tom Cruise imitation if I tried. But a lot of the stuff, but I was carrying the storyline that his character played in War of the Worlds. And they did want to make a reference to the Oprah thing. And I thought, well, what is the difference between the Oprah thing? They said, because that happened and everybody saw it. And it didn't have anything to do with anything other than that's aberrant behavior. That's out of the ordinary. And he himself made fun of it before the movie came out. Like he showed up on Leno and started jumping on the scene. Nobody remembers. But I knew we were cool, and I knew, you know, not that Tom Cruise was even aware of who I was, but I was fully prepared to, you know, just write him and say, listen, I don't want there to be any misunderstanding. These are cool people. But I don't think there was any need to do that. First of all, when you're in somebody like he and you're in his position, there's so much crap coming at you. I'm sure the last thing on his mind was, you know, was this stupid little movie. But I was prepared for it, and I had spoken to my agent, and I said, you know, I think I want to make that call. I just want to make sure that this guy should know that, you know, a lot of consideration went into what and how it was done. And when you're a public figure like that, you know, you got to accept a certain amount of ridicule. You got to listen to other people's opinions and look the other way. On my level, it's just I don't read reviews. I don't read it. If somebody's talking about me in a book, I don't want to read it, good or bad. I don't want to know, you know. On his level, I think it's sort of the graduate student version of that. You know, it's a much larger cross to bear.
Every time you get hit, feels like I'm getting hit.
He's old. He's arthritic.
I'm sorry, Jimmy. It's over.
Go home to me and the kids, Jim.
Go home with what? Go home with what?
They said I'm through, mate. There can't be a boxer no more.
You know, they keep cutting shifts down at the docks, and you just don't get picked every day.
That's it!
Well, we ain't got nothing left to sell.
I think we need to pack the kids.
You send them away, then all of this has been for nothing. If we can't stay together, that means we lost. That means we're giving up.
I got you a fight.
This one fight and one fight only.
Not a comeback.
Looks like they dug old Jim Braddock out of retirement.
Where the hell did that come from?
When again, then things maybe start getting serious.
What are you doing? You beat this guy easy last time.
Yeah, the same guy.
They say the paper's getting all sorts of letters from people saying you're their inspiration. Like you saved their lives or something.
Jimmy?
Are you scared for your husband's life? Max Baer's killed two men in the ring.
It's no joke, pal. People die in fairy tales all the time.
What's worth it, Jimmy? What's worth it?
I have to believe I got some kind of say over our lives. And when things are bad, we can do something about it. Make things better for our family.
I'm always behind you. I came to pray for Jim.
So did they. They all think that Jim's fighting for them.
This fight's as good as murder. First punch he lands, you'll sleep forever.
You gotta beat this! You gotta beat this from the inside out! From the inside out!
You can do it to me!
Cinderella Man.
You were kind of being a little Tom Cruise. To me, you were being more of his character from War of the Worlds than you were actually being Tom Cruise when it came to that film. But what was it like being Max Baer in Cinderella Man?
It was one of the first times I really needed to front load with research. First of all, I had to learn how to box because I'd never been in a ring before. So there was all of that. They set me up with the best boxing trainer there was, and I went to Brooklyn 6 days a week, and I just trained my ass off, literally trained it off, and went up there. You can't learn to box in under 2 years, but after 6 months, you can, if you work real hard, you can represent one. And that's what I wanted to do, to represent this boxer. And then once I had the fundamentals in my wheelhouse, I could begin to work on his physicality, which was very unique. He did a thing where he, first of all, the style was different. You know, the meat and potato boxers were, you know, their stance was different. He had a thing where he would wipe the sweat of his opponent when he punched his opponent. He didn't like having sweat on his gloves, so he wiped the sweat off on his shorts. So the physicality part of it was real fun, trying to get that down, watching tapes. Something really interesting happened. That was a movie where Ron Howard wanted to shoot all the fights in sequence. It was very humble. This is the mark of a great director. He just wanted to make a great movie. So having never made a boxing movie before, his only choice was to learn how to shoot boxing scenes during the movie. And if you see the movie, the boxing scenes get longer and longer from the first fight leading to, you know, the climactic fight between us. He wanted to learn how to shoot a fight by the time he got to our fight, so he'd be more in control of what he was doing. And he told me that too, which I thought that's just rare for a director to be able to balance humbleness with authority, which he definitely had. He's great administrator, great director. That was terrific. But I was very impressed by that. Then the fight itself, we originally had a terrific combat guy come in to work with Russell and I. Russell had also been working really hard, but on top of it, he was also starring in a movie. But he'd been training just as long, just as hard. And the idea was we both get up there about a month early and start working with this fight trainer who was going to build this climactic fight. And they thought that was cool because, you know, listen, it's a movie. And if you watch the actual fight, it's, you know, they don't move as quickly as movies do. But we ran out of time. And because of the learning curve, and how hard it is to shoot a move. But nothing ever goes the way you think. It's all you make it up as you go along. We had no other choice but to let the fight coordinator go, and they hired somebody else, and we simply transcribed every move in the actual fight and selected the moments, and we learned the fight. And the amazing thing was it forced me to make choices I wouldn't have known to make because I wouldn't have had the experience. But, you know, that whole thing was about Vadic moving Baer around so he can't get his right off because he didn't want to die. Because that was Bear's big weapon. So if he keeps moving him around, he doesn't have the leverage. Well, as the fight went on, because we were following the actual choreography of the fight, I actually felt off balance. It was really unnerving, and you can see it. And that and just the natural, there was a chemistry between Russell and I, which was also just, it was like lightning in a bottle, which was endlessly helpful and thrilling. He's such a good actor and so present that these fights had a real sense of a danger that you really don't see. I don't sense when I watch fights now. There's, you know, first of all, the gloves are larger. It's like they're hitting each other with pillows. You know, and these are dangerous guys who are fighting now. I wouldn't want to get in the ring with them, but back then it was like you were wearing a ski mitt, and when you hit each other, we would miss. You know, we both became very, very good. He's been doing it for years, but I became really good at pulling punches, and I think we trusted each other. You know, that we could get real close and make it look. We just wanted it to look real. But you're going to miss. When you feel a knuckle hit your face, it is a knuckle hitting your face, man. And that is just, it's like somebody shot a ham into your head. And even if it's pulled, even if it's a mistake, you know, there was one time where I think I walked into, you know, it gets tiring, and I walked into a punch and my nose started bleeding. I sat down and, I knew you can't inhale your nose. They had to wait, see that I, you know, it hadn't been broken. All of a sudden, you know, shit would go from a movie to real. And it's nobody's fault. It's just that, you know, it's tiring. Nobody should be boxing for 18 straight hours. And then there was another time where Russell, you know, he wanted to add another, like, and he was right. He wanted to add another punch. He said, send one into my side. I said, well, we haven't worked on it. I'd like to run it. He said, we don't have time. I trust you. And I sent it, and I hadn't pulled it. I tried to pull it, and he was great. I said, how was that? He goes, good, you know. But you can't help it. You just sort of, it's just, and in the end of the day, it's just guys, you get to roll around. It's like running around with a gun. It's just so fun. But it's hard work. Amazing to see, you know, somebody that I admire so much working, you know, and to actually see the pistons that drive the machine. That was a joy, but it was the difficulty in playing that role came after the fact, knowing that that's not what he was like. He was not a Dr. No. He wasn't a bad guy. He was a charming guy, and well liked. And he and Braddock ended up being very good friends. The nature of the warning, you know, when they end up in the same restaurant, and in the movie it's played as kind of a sinister, you know, you better watch your ass, I'm gonna kill you. It was, that actually did happen as we were shooting it. Somebody found out that meeting actually happened, but Bear actually did warn him. Bear had already killed, I think at that point, two guys, and it robbed him of the rest of his career, because he was so afraid that he was going to do it again, that he really genuinely was. But I don't know that had, now you don't have the same, it's not a simple Hollywood movie anymore. It's not a Frank Capra movie. Then it becomes something subtler. And if you do that, then Bear has to have more screen time, because he has to wrestle with that decision. And there just wasn't time for it. So it became much more simplistic. What son doesn't have an issue with his father? If somebody had only shown my father's dangerous moments and interpreted it like that, I'd have a problem with it. And Bear's son did have a problem with it. He was very public about it. But he was very kind to me. He said physically, you know, I don't have a problem with the acting. It was the point of view of the movie, which was to we just need to be careful. He was right. We need to be careful. When you're dealing with actual people who are alive or their relatives are alive, you need to be sensitive. And I agree. Not everybody agrees, but I agree. And I haven't reached out to him personally, but it's something I would like to do, you know, to Max Baer Jr. Plus, it'd be cool to meet him, you know, but to tell him that I, you know, how much respect I have for his dad. And I keep a picture of him still. And heartbreakingly, I'm found out that my grandfather had met Max Baer, had a picture taken with him, and we've lost it, which killed me. Just killed me. I keep hoping it'll show up one day.
You know, I don't really have a ring to give you or anything, but I was just wondering if you'd like to wear my name tag.
You gave her your name tag, right? In my day, that used to mean something.
Bjorn Epstein.
Sparhusen can't be far behind.
Blackmailing Bjorn Epstein.
Ah!
That is irony.
Piano player, can you accompany me while I try and find my key? I think it's around a middle C.
Spending so much time in the kitchen, we should just make our house a kitchen and call it Asia Tiska. That's what we did.
I'm Jay Bateman, the third Bateman sibling, the one that everybody never talks about.
How did you escape from the root cellar?
First into going broke, in with the ashes everywhere, and now they think they can beat Sweden?
Silly Iceland.
Ileana, do you need to take a break?
Where am I?
Where do you want to be?
North. I'm trying to find North.
I had a dream last night.
I've wasted a lot of time. A lot of time on chasing women that didn't mean anything to me.
Yeah, since when do you have feelings?
It just happened.
Time, love. It's only a change of time.
How did I get so lucky to find a girl like you?
I set my compass straight for you.
It's only a change of time.
Smile though your heart is breaking.
Well, I've always believed in have a nervous breakdown when your heart is breaking, but it's up to you.
Is there going to be another season of Easy to Assemble?
I have very, you know, that show is sort of my, like I said, I'm really interested in all that web stuff, and I know Ileana, and that was just an easy no-brainer because I got to observe her putting the show together and learn about that world myself, which is fascinating to me. You know, the idea of like brand and entertainment, and I think everything is moving towards the internet. It's an exciting time. And she's done, what is it, like five seasons? Is it five? Something like that. It's been three? Am I wrong? I don't remember.
I think just two, but I could be wrong.
No, I know it's more than two, so it must be three. And I was in the first season I did, the show was different. 5 minutes ago in the life of the internet is like 100 years ago in film. So things were extremely different. Nobody knew what they were doing. And the paradigm was to find the equivalent of a movie studio and have somebody produce your show. And the thing that Ileana did was she sort of showed everybody that you don't need anybody on the internet because, first of all, there's no money. So studios and agents, the whole industry that's built around the whole business aspect of Hollywood doesn't exist yet on the internet because there's no clear line between viewership and money yet. There's no gate. They haven't figured out how to put up a gate. So the smartest guys in Hollywood are trying to figure that out. How can we charge people for the internet? And they're beginning to do it. You know, they're figuring it out. But 2-3 years ago, they weren't even starting. And so she just went to IKEA and said, my career's going so badly that I work at IKEA. They're like, great, here's money. Pay yourself whatever you want and shoot it. Like, you know, nobody cares. At IKEA, she has like, there's almost nobody watching her. It's a branding opportunity, from that side of thing. I think it's a completely wasted opportunity from IKEA's point of view, but from her point of view, she got on the job training with somebody else's money, which is winning the lottery. The first season was run by, a misfit, who they gave the boot, who's kind of screwing them over. And then she sort of took things over herself to good and not as great effect, I think. You know, it's always good to have somebody supervising and calling you on your, and making you a better tennis player, you know, rather than to sort of grope around blindly, which is nice when you're in school. But I think, you know, I couldn't quite follow the where it was headed. Do you watch the show?
I watched them as they were coming out, and then I sat down and I watched them all from start to finish. And yeah. So, you're right. There were three seasons, and it looks like there might be a fourth, but I can't. Yeah. It doesn't seem that they're announcing anything yet.
Well, I think what happened was, they had a premiere in L.A., and it was shown as though it were a movie. And these things are written like they're a movie. You know, so they're cut into 10 segments. I know you know this. It's just for anybody who just doesn't know how these things are done. But that's basically, they tell you, write a screenplay, and then we'll figure out how to cut it into 10 segments, you know, or however many segments they need. And what happens is it's strange. If these things work in 5 to 10 minute segments, that's great, but they almost never work as a movie. They're intolerable. The only one I've seen actually pull, I couldn't stop watching it, was the thing called The Booth at the End. It's on Hulu. It's absolutely brilliant. It's through Buguru, which is Larry Kahn's runs that group for. So this is, and he's a magician with getting funding and all that. So I think his thing was, you know, the guy got a lot of money from Canada, and I think the deal was, you know, show this in Canada first, and we'll give you something like that. But anyway, this wonderful writer, this guy Chris Kubasik, wrote this piece called The Booth at the End, which was very internet production friendly because it's literally people sitting at a booth, but it's the Twilight Zone, and you don't know what's happening or who these people are until the last moment, and it leaves you wanting another season, which there's going to be. It's a very talented writer, a very sensitive writer, figuring out how best to use this emerging medium. And you get a sense of, God, I look at all this old stuff on Kinescope and television. I'm like, were people idiots in the 50s? Did like everybody become an idiot because this looks horrible? And then you realize, no, they came from radio and plays and movies, and nobody knew how to do this. And that's what everybody's fumbling around with now. It's so confusing. I love all the stuff that's happening on the internet. I love Twitter. That's how you and I, you know, stumble into each other. But so I love that connectivity, and I think it's a momentum that's moving forward, and nobody knows quite how it's going to play out. In the meantime, it's worth studying. And there's so many people that I see in Hollywood who, because there's no money, and they're not writers, they're more like producers, or they're agents or managers or whatever. What thrills them it's not creativity, it's trends. When they can interlock a trend and make sense out of a trend and make money out of that, it's just as exciting for them. It might be for you or I to have a creative experience. And I don't judge that, but what they don't experience is, oh, something big is coming. They don't have a sense that something big is coming because they're not interested. They're not interested until it starts paying off. And by then it will be a whole different game, you know? So I know a lot of people right now, like myself, who it was frustrating at first, and you think, oh, nobody's paying attention to this, and I really wanted to. Oh, this is my opportunity to actually not have to pay anybody. I don't have to pay anybody if I set things up now. And so I know a lot of people who are writing material, they're doing it very quietly. And then, you know, whatever emerges, as it emerges, hopefully, you know, they will have built something for themselves that's a business that's theirs, and nobody can stand between them and their money. That's the idea anyway, you know.
I know you said that you're writing something. What is that going to eventually be? Is it movie, TV, internet, or are you just trying to figure it out?
Well, someone who's been, a couple of people have been really, really helpful. I, to be blunt with you, I feel much more like a writer than I do an actor. It's just the acting, you know, took off. And at that point, certainly earlier in my career, it was appealing because it seemed to be the shortest, easiest route between me and women. And that was real. And that, and just making sure I had, what else did I want? I wanted everybody to love me as much as my mom, no questions asked. I wanted to be at least as rich as a very good dentist. That's what I wanted. And then I just loved acting, you know. And I'm a ham, and I like to be funny and all that kind of stuff. But along the way, I realized I also love and probably feel a little bit more like a writer. When I got to hang out with David Zucker, And I felt like I was in control of what it was I was hired to do. My questions were all about Kentucky Fried Theater and about the construction of these jokes, the rules that distinguishes their joke from, you know, a wannabe or a copycat. So the stuff that I'm working on, I've got a bunch of stuff, always a bunch of stuff in the hopper, and it's very, because I'm an actor, I've spent the last 20 years trying to get people's permission to be creative. And for a writer, it's exactly the opposite. For a self-starter like yourself, you know, I'm not sure what else you do other than the podcast, if anything, but it's, acting is unique in the sense that they're constantly asking people, somebody's writing your words, and there are people who feel creatively fulfilled by embodying those words, but it's not quite that for me. So also I've had the problem, which is, might have been a shorter, more effective way to answer what you'd asked before, which was playing a lot of different things has really just been a search for that thing that feels correct for me. I spent and continue to spend a lot of time, you know, bouncing around in TV because somebody claims to get me. I have a sensibility which isn't necessarily in accord with how people would cast me based on meeting me. Whereas that used to be confusing and frustrating for me, it's actually something I realized it sets me apart and I need to write for it. I need to write for it myself. And I had, you know, a couple of really positive experiences a couple of champions, to say the least, who've been supportive. Carrie Fisher is a friend and is somebody who, you know, was urging me to write and was helping me understand it. When I shot Cinderella Man, I got to write a few of my lines. Ron Howard, he thought that he was very funny, and he wanted me to actually have a go at that scene in the bar, but which was actually perfectly written. But I know we used one or two of my lines. Little things like that kept on along. There was some of my stuff in Three Stooges. And speaking of Three Stooges, another champion was Sean Hayes, who more than anybody else is somebody, you know, he's a producer now. He produces Grimm, he produces Hot in Cleveland, and he's also a brilliant actor, of course. But he took me to dinner and said, why aren't you doing this? Why aren't you producing and writing for yourself? And I said, I find it all very confusing, you know, and he helped. And he just said, look, it's because he's been through, it was almost like having an older brother who's had an experience and isn't it all competitive with you, and just said, look, do this first. So the thing that I'm writing is literally the smallest of the five projects that I feel ready to write. And I'm not kidding. Like I'm the only person in it, and I could even shoot it myself. And so based on that alone, it has a beginning, a middle, and an end. Probably be most at home on the internet, but it could be an independent movie too. But it's a sort of typical hero's journey story about somebody who has something to learn meets a version of himself without giving anything away, and walks away changed, or this other self. It's not even that weird. It's fulfilling because it's I don't like things that aren't about anything. I don't like odd movies that are just odd. You know, like I love good science fiction. Ultimately, I loved 13th Floor because it was about somebody accepting their world and finding love and choosing love over loneliness. And which just seemed almost pedestrian to me, and told in this very colorful way. But the reason that movie works for me is because it's a lovely story with a satisfying ending. And that's what this thing that I'm working on is. I'm shy about revealing anything just because I've had stuff. I lost my cherry in having somebody take something, which is just an awful experience. It's a rite of passage. It's just awful. Every writer I've spoken to has had it done. It was done in a heinous way, but how do you do something like that and come, you know, it never smells like cologne. So I'm very protective of it, which is good because that means you can't shoot your mouth off in Starbucks. You actually have to write, which is hard.